Today I'm going to talk about social media, artificial intelligence, and consider what are the implications of the development of these powerful technologies in our lives. There are many positive to speak of, but there are also threats to our freedoms. We have some sovereignty, and that space of freedom is our consciousness. It's this private space where we can decide what we want to think about. Yet increasingly, we're thinking the thoughts of algorithms or the thoughts of other people. So says the author Michael Pollan, who writes about consciousness. So to what extent are we at risk of handing over the sovereignty of our minds and hearts to machines, to artificial intelligence, and allowing what we come across on social media to influence how we understand the world? Did you ever have the feeling that your mother didn't want you hanging around with certain people because they might be a bad influence on you? Well, we're all at risk of hanging around with the people who might be a bad influence on us. But it's not on the street corners or in the disco. It's on the small screens. And our small screens are full of them. We do risk falling under their influence. We risk giving up our freedom to think for ourselves, the foundational freedom upon which all other freedoms are built and depend. During the recent fuel protests, I stumbled upon a few videos on social media. They recounted the tragic story of a farmer who had died after participating in the protests in Dublin. He reportedly returned home after the fuel protest and died in tragic circumstances. Now, those videos were heartbreaking, showing men deeply upset and inconsolably broken as they shared the story of a man who couldn't see any way through this cost of living crisis. However, the truth was that no incident occurred. There was no farmer who died in those circumstances. I suspect the men who posted those videos didn't realize this. They trusted the news they read on their social media feeds and shared their emotional and angry reactions with the world. These men were expressing their empathy and their sorrow, offering condolences to a man's family. They also called for continued protest and stronger opposition to what they believed is government inaction on the cost of living. It wasn't a simple case of disinformation leading to misinformation. It was deliberate deception and manipulation. The intention was to create maximum protest by any means necessary. And if I can create the greatest rage, it will lead to the greatest reaction. And if I can throw into that rage anti-immigrant sentiment, homophobia, transphobia, misogyny, and whatever you're having yourself, all the better. Here we risk surrendering the freedom to be decent, dignified, and truthful. Staying on the subject of misinformation and disinformation, there's two stories going around social media relating to David Attenborough and two prominent people, the Mayor of London and the White House Press Secretary. Attenborough apparently had some disagreement with them and, of course, emerged a hero by his expert debating skills. It was all fake news. Nothing happened. Now, as a result of my opening and reading these stories, the algorithm, which I'll talk about in a second, is feeding me more and more the same. So when I open up my Facebook later, I'm going to see more about this fake news. At best, some of these stories demonstrates our deep empathy for people's struggles, but it also highlights how easily we can relinquish our freedoms. How do we discern what's real and what's fake? Algorithms, you might have heard of those. It's a key process working under the hood of social media and the internet in general. And its purpose is to capture and hold our attention to the end that I will click on a product and buy something. But algorithms also work to capture my attention towards a particular worldview, to the end that I will be influenced. Now, it can achieve a number of things. My opinions will be changed, or my existing biases will be cemented, baked in, given credence, acknowledged, confirmed, and affirmed. Now, to explain how they work as easily as I can, we could take a simple example. So I open the internet and I do a search for a clothing brand to find a specific shirt. I find it and I complete a purchase. Great. However, the next time I check my social media or browse the internet, I will see ads for shirts and shops selling them. If I've watched a video of a protest, which happened, I will be given more videos of protests. So the algorithm analyzes your past behavior, your likes and your clicks, and then will feed you content based on those clicks, likes, or searches. And the goal isn't just to show you content, it's also to show you content that will keep you on the app for as long as possible, scrolling, scrolling, scrolling. I missed my bus stop last week because of this. I worked for a couple of years on an internet safety program for young people. As you know, I was a youth worker for many years. Now, the internet safety program was divided into short modules for use in a youth work setting. And it dealt head on with the good, the bad, and the ugly of the online world. Its purpose was to enable young people navigate the online world. But the magic was that it was facilitated in a trusting, non-formal youth work setting where trusted adults engage young people in conversations and activities on something young people are very interested in. And if serious issues arose, the adult in the room could respond and support a particularly vulnerable young person. Also, the young people engaged voluntarily. It wasn't like school. Now, it's all very well to have programs to deal with issues that young people have to confront on a daily basis, but risks will remain, and not every young person will have access to these programs. Now, on a positive note, young people do find some very fulfilling and positive online communities. It can be particularly crucial for young people who are isolated. Young people can find their tribe. But numerous court rulings around the world have found that social media companies intentionally design their platforms to be addictive to children, leading to serious mental health issues like depression, anxiety, and body dysmorphia. Last month, the European Commission issued a preliminary finding against a particular social media company for failing to prevent children under 13 using their networks. And that is in breach of the Digital Services Act. And this week, you might have noticed, it was on the agenda in the Oireachtas. Now, social media companies, in fairness, deny that their products are harmful, and they tell us that they are working hard to make online spaces safe for children and young people. But they also admit that not every piece of harmful content will be filtered out. They admit that children and young people will be exposed to harmful content. But we must do better. It is my contention that society as a whole is failing to protect young people from harm. And it isn't just a problem for young people. My recent experience of viewing content related to the fuel protests shows this. We are all vulnerable. So I'd like to talk about how we might begin to protect young people from the harms associated with social media. And as parents, as guardians, as carers, as anyone who works with young people, there's a few things we can do. One key safety measure we can do is to provide young people with real-world experiences where the smartphone or tablet is not required. Another is to set clear rules around online time, because you are in charge. Better still, delay allowing children to have a smart device in their hands. But talk to your children, engage them about the online world. Another idea is to gather all the parents in the school, create a community to talk about this and start early. Perhaps agree a code about when a smartphone may eventually find its way into the hands of your children. But probably most crucially of all, model good behavior. So what about AI or artificial intelligence? Throughout history, humanity has always sought more knowledge and a better understanding of the world. And at best, new technology is beneficial. For example, look at the advances in medical science that have led to longer and healthier lives. And AI is playing no small part in this. Think of what the pencil, the printing press, the telescope have done for human advancement. Once upon a time, the only job was survival, and we transitioned from hunter-gatherers to farmers and toolmakers. This shift created new roles like blacksmiths, basket makers, and potters. Then there was time for creativity, allowing for pursuits such as music, art, writing, poetry. Onwards and upwards, forward through the ages, and here we are today. People are now paid to play video games. They're paid to dine out and review wonderful restaurants, and they are paid to travel to exotic places and tell us all about them. What would our parents, our grandparents, have thought of that? And once cherished professions are now jobs at risk. Job disruption has been a constant in human evolution, and the rapid development of artificial intelligence is displacing jobs at, some say, an unprecedented rate. Vlad Tenev is a technological entrepreneur, and he has considered this issue. And he talks at length about the extraordinary growth of artificial intelligence. And he notes a recurring feeling of exceptionalism across generations. People, and I don't think we're any different, believe that we are at the point of discontinuity, where history ends and a new world begins with no precedent. Now, this could be true this time. We don't know if we're building a super assistant or an apex predator. However, being hypervigilant about threats to our survival is a key part of our survival mechanism and evolution. It's what makes us human. And Vlad offers some straightforward yet valuable advice for young people and their parents who are concerned about future job prospects. He advises against letting predictions of job disruption prevent you from pursuing something you are passionate about, and I concur. Follow your passions and interests for greater fulfillment and happiness. The OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, acknowledges AI's potential to tackle complex challenges. It enhances education and healthcare. It drives scientific innovation, and it is an extraordinary assistant when it comes to climate action. However, it also highlights risk to privacy, to safety, to security, and human autonomy, freedom. Free will must be considered at this point. Free will is the sovereignty we possess above all other ideas and opinions. And when we're simply thinking the thoughts of others fed to us by those insidious algorithms, we begin to relinquish that sovereignty. We are biological beings, thankfully. Feelings and instincts remain powerful human traits no technology can replicate or replace. However, humans can manipulate those feelings and instincts and masterfully use technology to do so. Those men I mentioned at the beginning of this address, who were genuinely and deeply moved by an untrue story about a tragic event linked to the fuel protests, they were shamelessly manipulated. People did it, and technology merely enabled it. And I have become extra cautious when encountering stories that move me. I know that the freedoms I enjoy in this society can only be dreamed of by those in other parts of the world. But often I fear that I live in a kind of curated cocoon. While I believe I'm seeing the world for what it is, I might be trapped in that comfortable prison of my own existing biases. I'm protected and I'm happy in my own echo chamber. We are all at risk of unknowingly surrendering our freedoms. Freedom is our consciousness, that private space where we can decide what we want to think about. Now, a caveat. This community is on social media, hoping the algorithms will capture the attention of some spiritual seekers out there and drawing them into our Unitarian space. Before coming through that door, people will generally first check us out online. They will look at our social media. They will look at our website. Before I walked through those doors, I did. So we need to be there. It's one of our shop windows. But I must say, what kept me coming week after week was a real-world experience, not something given to me online. It was the welcomers that Sunday morning. And I can't emphasize how important welcomers at the door are. So thank you to all who do that Sunday after Sunday. I mentioned the bad, the good, and the ugly of the online world. But I want to focus on the good for a moment. I want to quote a letter that appeared in the Irish Times last year. And I quote, "Sir, I refer to the octogenarian John Burnett's letter in Thursday's Irish Times, where he comments that he's too busy looking out on the world to allow his smartphone to dominate his life. I don't allow that either, but as a mainly housebound nonagenarian, that is someone in their 90s, mine does play a hugely important part in my life. My family literally keep me in the picture. In the last fortnight, I've attended a wedding in Scotland, another in Italy, and yesterday, oh joy, I met my newborn great-granddaughter in England for the first time. No wonder my smartphone provides such a bonus window on my world. I'd be lost without it. Yours, etc., Jane Meredith." Yes, that's our beloved Jane Meredith. Hello, Jane. I hope you're with us online this morning. So, our online networks can be so important to us for all the reasons Jane mentions. So, to conclude, may we defend the freedom of our minds. You are free to disagree, to agree, to disbelieve and to question. You're free to reject the premise of a story or a statement and anything that insults your soul. Our window here honors and celebrates human effort in science, in human compassion, and the pursuit of truth. So may we always honor and celebrate human effort in science, compassion, and the pursuit of truth. And may we always protect our freedom, never surrendering it to those who would seek to manipulate our inner goodness. Amen.